The Arthur Thompson, Reel 4.
I had them. What we had in the morning, we had to get up very early in the morning before going to work. We got kanji. We had, of course, a blackboard, you know, in each hut. And there's a blackboard in the kitchen also to see what the meals were. And they gave some fantastic meals, but nothing much to eat there. Then lunch, we had, stew, they call it. There was no beef, no meat. All the vegetables that they could pick up, watery, you know. Put some sauce in it, a little bit of rice in it, bobo rice. You see a little bit of rice floating inside and all that. That was brought to us in tubs, big tubs. And dinner, of course, we had some kind of a bread. They call it bread, but it's not that bread, as I told you, made of this, corn flour, starch flour, sticky thing, you know, and some stew, they call it something like that. Sometimes they call it a riso, made with rice flour, tapioca and rice flour mixed up. And coming back to the food again. Right, the measurement would be done like this. Some helpers in the hut with a quartermaster with the detail, these two or three, four people to go to the kitchen and carry the tubs back to the hut that we were in. And all these huts were numbered 1, 2, 3, 4, and the camp was divided into four quarters, north, south, east, west. And the rations would be, how we get our rations would be all of us are numbered. We carry our cans or plates and wait for our turn, and they got the measurement, a kind of dipper, you know, with a tin at the end of it, and you know exactly you get the half a pint or a quarter pint or 300 grams or whatever the measurement was. Each person gets the same quantity, you see, and they got a stick, like they clean it on the top. Yes, kanji in the morning, it's no sugar, no milk, just rice flour cooked with the or rice flour. If not rice flour, it's the other thing. It's jagung flour, jagung, corn flour, cooked soft porridge. You call it, make a porridge, and there's no sugar, no milk. Then after everybody has got his share, then we wait for seconds. Sometimes a little bit left in the tub, seconds up. Short quartermaster's call of seconds. And you remember now, which is the last number he sees on the board. He says the last person who had his seconds but previous day was, say, number 27. Then number 28, it was myself, I walk up and get my, and 28, 29, 30, 31, up to 32 or 33, then stop. You write on the board 33. Then the next person knows the next seconds, so start from 34 onwards. And that's the meals we get for the day. And now, if you might be wanting to know if you've got anything special once in a while, like in the Easter Sunday, or might say, just as you see on Sundays, where you get something better. And that's where our kitchen, the cooks, we call them, they get together and see how best they can make use of the rations they get. They get so much of the ration. What they do is they give us a little bit less to eat at lunchtime or less at breakfast, and give us a bit more at dinner time. Give us something nice, like a riso, they call it. And once I remember we had the pigs were killed. The pigs were red in camp. And that was supposed to be distributed for 6,000 people. 4,000 men and 2,000 women, 1,800 women, was 6,000 internees. Can just imagine how much pork we had. We hadn't had hardly any taste of pork. We imagine we had some pork in it. Can hardly taste it. And that was kept, they made a kind of riso, and they chopped it up very, very fine. And sometimes they bring it from outside, little belacan. Belacan, you know, that's the paste. Mm. And put it in a stew, mix it up. Make some kind of stew, they call it stew. Well, if you look at it today, you'll think that's pig's food. Not appetizing at all, but we are hungry, anything you can eat then, you see, you'll eat. Mm. And for a drink, a tea, as I repeated again, it's just a tub, hot water poured inside, and some tea leaves. This is not the tea leaves you get today, Ceylon tea. We get some kind of leaves, which they call tea leaves, a large size, you know. And you get a kind of a dark brown color, you know, a dark greenish, brownish color, like. And that's supposed to be tea, hot water poured inside. And each fellow gets a can of it. And there's no sugar, no milk there again.
Yes, then what about drinking water?
Well, water, if you want to drink water, you can go to the tap and get water. There are bathrooms nearby, see, drinking water from the tap. You pour water in a glass and drink.
Is the water clean?
Well, the water is supposed to be... These were all done by the internees. Because at the early stages, the internees were internees they were in Changi Prison. And Changi Prison was a place that no, all four walls, nothing to see, you can't do anything there. So it was a good idea when they put us in, they put the internees. I wasn't there, I was out at that time. This is the story I got from the internees. And they started this time road camp, they built huts. And they made boreholes, that's a toilet hole supposed to be, and covered a little bit, enough little bit covering. And of course they built all the pipes, all done by the internees. But you must remember, amongst the internees, we had plumbers, we had technicians, we had engineers, we had architects, we had doctors, we had lawyers, we had everything, even police personnel and government officers, every trade you might think in the camp, you see. And some of them invented, made their own medicine too in camp, you might say, from rubber seeds, you know, and from the soil. If you had diarrhea, they take a little bit of the earth, and some kind of earth they cut down the side of the hill, a white portion, and mix with water, something, and drink it, that stops your diarrhea and dysentery. You know what I mean? Listen to you, if you had diarrhea at least. So, that's it. And the pipes were made, you know, in such a way with showers. There was no privacy there, you know. Mm. And there was a big, a little bit of a covering like that, you know. And pipes running on top, overhead, and down below. And he had showers, and they all bathed like that, you see.
Yeah.
The same with the women's camp also.
Now, who's in charge of the cooking for such a large mass of people?
Well, the camp was very well organized. The Europeans organized itself, the Japanese had nothing to do. Mm. We had our camp commandant, they call it, the chief. Then each hut had an area, a hut representative. Then we had an area representative also representing one whole area. Four areas, they were north, south, east, west. Mm. And they had Japanese words for that. I remember one word, kita. Kita meaning north. I was in the north area. Mm. Then it made boreholes and all that. And then you see the kitchen, the cooks, they had those who were cooking. They would keep put their heads together in the evening and calculate and see how much rice they got from the store. And out of that quantity, they had to work. Some mathematics had to be done to calculate the number of people in that area, how much they're going to eat, how many grams of rice they can cook, and how much they can get out of that ration. They had to make good, that ration if it's going to last us a month, and each day how many, you know. But the quantity was supposed to be, they did all the calculation. And each hut, they said, had a quartermaster. And it was his job to go to the kitchen, speak to the chief there. And the chief would tell him, well, you got so many people in your hut, today's ration, each person gets a quarter pint. Or next ration, maybe half a pint each person, you see. And he knows, he works it out. How many, and then he knows, of course, you've got 30 people, and each person gets half a pint, that means 15 pints, right? You see, that's how he works out, you see.
Now, were these cooks the interns?
The cooks were interns, all Europeans. They were all Europeans, and they're not very young people. I volunteered to cook because I learned some cooking, I might mention this, while I was doing, while I was outside. I had nothing to do, I learned my mother. Mother taught me how to cook, you see. And I thought I could help them out in the kitchen, but I wasn't allowed to. That Japanese wouldn't allow any young person to go in the kitchen. More elderly people did cooking. And for the ladles, for mixing up the stews, they had big cauldrons to cook. They used steel helmets. I remember this very well. Steel helmets used in the war. They put a long stick, they made a kind of a piece of iron sticking out like that with screws, and that was used for stirring the stew or whatever they cooked, the kanji and things like that, see, for cooking. All helmets. And then these were hung up after, you could see hung up, and they washed and kept dry. Of course, sometimes you get bandage dropping, the cook's bandage falls in the stew, and you get it. Once the lock gave, fell inside, and I brought up the lock to the quartermaster. I said, I found a lock inside. I said, keep it. He said, you might find the key the next day.
The ladies help with the cooking?
The ladies, of course, had their own cooking to do. They did their own, you see.
What do you mean by they had their own? I thought that...
They had their own cooks. They do, I can't remember exactly whether... The men did the cooking. I'm sorry, the ladies didn't do any cooking. The men did the cooking, the hut nearest to the ladies' camp. The ladies all stayed to themselves. They all, separate huts for themselves. And the men did all the cooking, and they will come, and the men will take the food and bring it to the huts there. Mm-hmm. And then after they finish eating, they'll take it back to the men's hut again. So all the cooking was done by the men. The ladies didn't do any cooking, that's right. They cook their rations as well. There was only about 100, I think there was one, I'm sorry, not 100, 1,600 or 1,800 women.
Mm.
And the men, we had about 4,000 odd men.
Mm. And how many non-European personnels were there?
Oh, there were many, many.
There
were Chinese,
remember?
There were Eurasians, and there was what they called Norwegians, and people were fighting in the vast wars. Like there was some, not Germans, sorry,
mm-hmm.
there was some Australians, Canadians, British, Dutch. Dutch also were fighting in the wars, and the Americans, and they had South Africans. All those that were allies in the last war, fighting either the Germans against the Germans or the Japs.
Yeah, can you remember what's the ratio like between the personnels and the interns? What I mean by personnels is the Japanese and their assistants.
Well, the Japanese who looked after the internees,
mm-hmm.
Were actually not military personnel, you know, in the sense of the word. They might have used Japanese military uniform, but they were civilians.
Mm-hmm.
They didn't have any guns with them, nothing at all. They lived in a house called the greenhouse. They had a house, you know, there was a club before nearby, you know, old pre-war days. There must have been a house, a club or something there. And they lived in a greenhouse, which is very near to our camp. There was a brick building. And they would come down once in a while. You see, how they communicated with us was like this. We had a camp commandant, a European who was in charge of the whole camp.
Mm.
Well, he will get news from the Japanese. And he will prepare bulletins, news bulletins to be sent to the camp. And they had, of course, like an office, your little typewriters, someone will do the typing, you see. And little boys would run, and messenger boys would run out and give a message.
Mm.
And every hut gets a message. And these bulletins, you would call it, were read out after your last meal in the day. After you get your dinner, when everybody is seated and finished, then he says, your attention, please. That's a bulletin to be read out then. And he reads out the bulletin. And the bulletin, of course, nothing much in the bulletin. The bulletin only says, sometimes it says somebody has committed an offense and what punishment he got. And we had our own little courtroom where the person gets charged and he gets punishment. Well, it's punishment in a way. He gets rations cut. You know what I mean? It's extra rations like Gula Melaka.
Mm.
Gula Melaka we had to pay.
Mm.
And we had a salary, I think it was something like $15 or $20 a month, Japanese money, you know.
Mm.
And that we could buy a little bit of Gula Melaka, $20 each person, you know. The Japanese paid us in their currency.
Yes. You did mention about the Japanese assistants, some of them were the Europeans. Were there any other nationalities helping the Japanese?
Helping the Japanese there?
Yeah. To look after the camp.
Yeah, guards, huh? That's right. The Japanese are the officers of the camp, administrators, you can say. About four or five of them stayed there, five or six of them maybe.
Mm-hmm.
And we nicknamed them. One was known as Puss in Boots because he had boots on all the time.
Mm-hmm.
Another one was known as Blue Socks. Because he used blue socks.
Mm.
Another one was Tommy Naga. I don't know his name was Tommy Naga. Puss in Boots, blue socks. And we gave them different names, nicknames. You know who they were, you see.
Mm.
And the guards, of course, they were Malay and the Sikh guards.
Mm.
These guards are supposed to be like police. They gave them khaki shorts, maybe.
Mm.
And they didn't have any gun. They just had a stick with something pointed at them. Steel, a piece of pointed... metal at the top of it, see,
mm-hmm.
like as though they were sentries. I mean, they were made sentries. They were guarding the camp, you know, outside, and used to walk around the outside of the camp area
mm-hmm.
in twos. Covered a very big area, you know.
Mm-hmm.
And there was barbed wire all around the outside, you see.
Mm-hmm.
And if we did go out the camp, they'll be watching us.
Mm-hmm.
And they can be quite nasty too. If you don't bow to them, they can slap you. I know of an instance of a. An instance where a European lady did not bow to this Sikh fellow, and he had a slap across the face. You know, that was before I got in the camp.
Mr. Thompson, can you briefly tell us how food is provided or supplied?
Food was supplied this way: rice, of course. The Japanese got in the rice, and there was not sufficient rice that could go around the whole camp. And we had to grow our own vegetables. We had a lot of land there, that's one thing. ground, and that was being utilized for planting of vegetables, sweet potatoes, tapioca. He grew a lot of tapioca in camp. And these were being collected every morning by a group of workers whose job was to, you know, cut all the leaves, the vegetables, and whatever tapioca was ready to be pulled out of the ground, that was collected and brought to the kitchen. That was their job. And of course, the cooks did their cooking was differently. Rice, as I told you, rice was not sufficient to go right round. So the rice, they used a very little rice. You can hardly taste the rice. And there was rice that you could get, that was only meant for the workers. As far as I remember, those that did very hard work outside, that category of worker, internee, he was entitled to 150 grams of rice, you know, that's hard rice, that's rice that we get these days. And then the other workers inside the camp, they did less hard work, they got 75 grams a day. Of course, those that didn't work, they had no rice. They didn't get any rice at all.
Yes, can you briefly say something about the utilities there, like water, electricity, and sanitation?
Water, there were pipes, you know, laid in the camp that was done by the internees themselves before they moved in from Changi, that's what I understood. They had showers, they built in showers. Showers are just common showers. What should I say? You see, at the end of each hut, or two huts combined together, there was an open space and a little bit of a zinc covering the sides, you know, a little bit. And there were showers, and that's where the internees had their baths in the evening, you know. Yeah, anytime they wanted to bathe, you know, especially after work, after their work during the day. And then we had the little taps there around, you know, just outside where the bathroom was supposed to be. That's supposed to be a bathroom, but there's no cover on top, you know. Just as I said, just a little bit of a covering. Not much of a privacy there anyway. But water, you could open the tap and drink some water. You get the cup and take water you want to. And then we had what you call boreholes. As I told you, we were out in Siam Road, on the top of the hills, you know, down the valleys and hills around, surrounding that terrain in that area was just hills and valleys, like, you know, up and down. And they made boreholes, like deep holes in the ground. That was for your, you know, for you when you had to ease yourself. And that was covered with the piece of wood, you might say, you know, a little wood covering on the top. And that also had a little bit of a covering in the sides as well. And what they did internally, that they grew some vegetable creepers to cover the sides. That's what it is.
Oh. Yeah, you were mentioning that you have got water pipes.
Water pipes, yeah.
Now, where's the source of the water supply?
Well, the water came up from our reservoir, from the mains outside.
Which reservoir in particular?
It was the Makrichi Reservoir, I think we had those days, Makrichi Reservoir. We still get water supply from there, you know.
Has the camp suffered from any dry spell in which you have to ration water?
No, there was no dry spell, actually. Yes, I forgot about the electricity now. We talked about water and electricity. Well, we had lights in the huts, all the huts that were erected there. And I think these lights came from some generator near, you know, nearby, or maybe it came from the there's a brick building there where the Japanese officers who looked after the internees, maybe it was tapped from that side, from that source. And these lights were controlled by one switch. There was one switch where the lights went automatically came on when it was time for it to come on, say about 6:30 maybe, 7 o'clock. Then it went off in an hour's time, say about 8:30, the lights went off. And we were in total darkness, the whole camp lights got off.
Yeah, talking about electricity, do people make use of irons during those times? Irons to rest their clothes.
No, nobody could make any use of any iron because you didn't have any power plugs, any independent power plugs, you know what I'm saying? Where you could put in a switch and ironing them. I didn't see anybody with an iron there. But there was some electricity maybe that was used in the workshop. Mm. Oh, we had many workshops. Men of different trades. You know, something like a big, like a little town. It's a miniature town when they started work in the morning. It's funny to say, those who had to go out in the open, they did very hard work like I did in order to get 150 grams of rice a day. That was digging of tunnels. We were making tunnels, you know, outside. We did the very, very hard work and putting railway tracks, you know, sleepers, and pushing the carts and the carriages inside to put the earth, you know, and empty it outside, the tunnels. These tunnels, I understood, but the chaps, they said they were being made to store food, because they anticipated this going to be a big fight here in Singapore. See? They were preparing for a fight, and that is why the British were coming back. But on the other hand, it wasn't so. They were supposed to put us in there, and when the fighting starts, and burn the both ends of the tunnel, something like that we heard.
Yes. Before we get into more details into that subject, can I come back to the living conditions again?
Yeah.
Can you tell something about the accommodation? How were people arranged, you know, in their different quarters?
Well, the camp, it was all huts, you know. There were some original buildings, like in the hospital. They had, I don't know, what do you say, something like a barrack house, like, you know, like a barrack house, some sort of barrack houses. Little steps going up, and there was wooden flooring, windows all around. That was the only thing that was original from, you know, from before it was built. They must have had some quarters around about the area there. Well, they made use of those for the sick people. And the other internees, they had to be satisfied with staying in huts. At the panel, both covered the sides and covered the top, and just a long hut, say about, well, I think about 200 feet long, I suppose. And we all stepped side by side in the hut. And we were numbered 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, and maybe 60, 70, 80, 100 people in that hut, or, you know, something like that. And these huts were arranged. They weren't so very close. Sometimes one hut was another 50 yards away, another hut, another 20 yards away, something like that, another hut, you know, another 100 yards, maybe you find a hut down the hill, up the hill. And all these huts were numbered 1, 2, 3, hut number 10, number 15, number 20, and so on. No? They were all numbered. And so were the internees numbered as well.
Now, how were the people allocated to these huts? On what basis?
Well, when I went in, the Eurasians had the huts. The older internees built the huts for us, preparing for our intake of us, Eurasian internees, when I told you the last 6 months of the war, before the war ended. And we were all... The Eurasians had their own huts. I think there were two huts for the Eurasians, and another hut was for some of the Eurasians from Bahau were brought down Singapore, and another hut for Jews, British Jews, and so on. No? So what happened is, we would have stayed there up to the end if it wasn't for two of our Eurasian boys who ran away, escaped. They escaped and they came back, and they were not detected, you know, when they came back, and of course they got a wall up in them. So when that happened, the Japanese authorities thought that Eurasians were bad people, they could not be trusted, you know. So what they did is, they made us mix up with all the Europeans. Some of the European and old internees came to us hut where we were, and we had to shift to all the huts around the area where all the Europeans were, you know, the old internees. Like the five of us from this hut went to hut number 10, another five went to hut number 4. And so on, so on, so on, all around the camp. You know, we were distributed throughout the camp to the old internees.
Now, were they divided in accordance to their race, or to the sex, or to the age?
The main division was the men and women, as I told you before. Mm-hmm. The women, there were about 1,000 odd, you know, 1,006, 1,008. Mm-hmm. And they were housed. They were camped in the women's camp. There was a subdivision, I mean, there was a division between the men. The men were in the men's camp, and they met once a week, as I said, on a Sunday. They met in the orchard, those who had their husbands on the other side of the camp, met the children, met in the orchard, and for about an hour, I think an hour and a half, 2 hours, they could chit-chat and bring something to drink and eat, maybe they want. So that was how the camp was divided.
Yes, and what about the children?
When nationality was concerned, you know, whatever it is, we all mixed together and we were all known as enemy. We were enemies anyway. There was no difference between Americans or British or French, Germans, or not Belgium, but French, or the Australians and so on. The
no.
children, yes, as you
yes.
as you just said, sorry, they could stay with the mothers if they were small, say up to, then they, what I remember is this, up to 10 years of age. Once the boy comes to the age of 10, he is being transferred to the men's camp. He goes to his father. He stays with the father. Then father looks after him.
I'd like to know also whether there were schools, you know, for these children in the camp.
Yes, there were. As I say again, it was a little bit of a town when life started in the morning,
mm-hmm.
you know. In the morning early, when you got up at a certain time, you had to get up very, very early after breakfast. But after our breakfast, we'll have to go to our different sections. So we're going to work, and different types of work we had to do. The children, of course, they had to go to school. And some of the teachers that were interned in camp, some of the brothers were in camp as well. You know, the brother schools, and they taught them their lessons. Whatever books they had to make good whatever they had. You see. And I think they had a blackboard which you can write, and you make use of it. They had a little chalk for them, whatever they could, but they had to use it very sparingly.
Yes, yeah. Can you remember how a classroom activities was like in those
days? Well, the classroom, there was no classroom. They say that the class would be under a big tree, maybe a shady tree, or a little bit of a shed, you know, a little bit of a zinc top and top covering, under a tree maybe. At the back of another hut, maybe something. That would be the school.
Yeah.
And they had an office, you know, as I'll tell you. I'm going to tell you now. An office where we had, as I say, the camp commandant, they called him. He was the head. And he maintains, dialogue with the Japanese officers. He's a man that they speak to. If they're going to tell him anything, any news, what's going to happen, this and that, rations. And he'll have to send the news to the other huts. Hut representatives, all the different areas, the four areas, and the news goes out. The news is being typed. There was a typewriter, I remember. There was a little office where these news bulletins were being prepared, and they were sent out by young boys to the different huts, you know?
Yes, I know. You did mention about it.